Pick up your paintbrush. It's time for Hobby Support Group.
Good morning, Andy.
Good morning, Tom. How are you today?
I'm fine, thank you, this morning. And how are you?
I'm very good. I've got a lovely glass of orange squash to see me through this episode. Have you got a tipple on your desk?
I have a nice tankard of mixed berry summer squash.
Oof, wild.
Pushing the boat out on this Monday morning.
Oh, yeah, you've got to treat yourself, haven't you? We're looking at campaigns today, aren't we, Tom?
Yep, we are having our thoughts and ideas and probably many a tangent on what we see are campaigns, the pros, cons, neutrals about running campaigns for everything from skirmish games to D&D to complex war games.
Oh, sounds good to me.
The main segment.
That dictionary defines a campaign as a joint endeavor. And obviously, there's, you know, marketing campaigns and role-playing campaigns and military campaigns. What campaigns do you, when you think of campaigns, what do you think of, Tom?
I think campaigns, especially in like a gaming sense, sort of fall into some sort of relatively quite well-defined categories. Mm-hmm. You have the short series of linked games that might be played over a few weeks.
Yeah.
Sort of like the Judge Dredd, Strontium Dog series of games.
Yeah.
Where, you know, you might have like this entire campaign is 3 weeks, you know, three games.
Yeah.
Linked together. You also have like another style of campaign is an open-ended series of games where your force improves from game to game. These can be things like Frostgrave, Blood Bowl, quite a lot of the sports games, you know, Necromunda, those kind of things. Quite often these games, while in theory being open-ended, you know, like you can play 100 games of Frostgrave with the same warband, but a campaign will quite often have like a fixed number of games to determine the win at the end of it. For example, the Stench Bowl has 10 games of Blood Bowl, the winning team at the end of that.
It doesn't have to be a fixed number. It can be a fixed period of time as well. You might say, this year, we're playing Frostgrave, and however many number of games you get in that time period is how many games you get in.
Yeah. The slow grow type of campaign, where you may start off initially building and painting a small skirmish force, while building towards a large-scale army, which sort of gives you the time to build and paint that force. You know, this is the thing that we did with the English Civil War campaign.
Right.
You know, we initially played with, you know, 50 figures. We're now playing with, like, 100, you know, 500 figures.
Yeah. And I know there's one of the play styles for Warhammer 40,000 at the moment is the idea is you start with a smaller group and it builds that army and they get experience. So you know, it's a good way to start an army, isn't it?
Yep, and it's like from our interview the other week with Steve, you know, if you're playing bolt action, you might start off playing firefight with a squad of 10 guys.
And yep.
You then go up to 500 points. You then go to 1,000 points. You know, like, especially for things like 40K bolt action, it's a great way of getting a force together. You know, one sense, it's probably how most of us got started in the hobby. You know, like when I was a kid, I'd go to the GW shop and buy whatever I had enough money in my pocket to buy. So like, this month, my army gets a multi-melter attack bike. Next month, it gets a box of Marines. Or, you know, I bought a Bloodthirster instead for my Space Wolves. Don't know how I'm going to fit this in. But it's
that's like my first army is like a Chaos Dwarf bazooka. And a Lehman Russ and some elves.
The slow grow type of campaign is a really great way of keeping enthusiasm and engaged in a project that's going to take you months, if not even years, to sort of build. Well, actually, all you can sort of, it's something that you can all work towards together and showing off your progress and actually get playing with figures before you build them. Like, you know, we're probably looking at playing some games like Sharp Practice and other smallish Napoleonic games before we've all got a couple of hundred Napoleonic figures painted. It's a great way of doing that. And then the other campaign system that I would imagine most gamers are familiar with is the RPG campaign of D&D things. And these can take, you know, couple of sessions to run, or you can have a campaign that has been running for decades and decades. Yeah. There is, you know, how long is an RPG campaign? Is it how long is a piece of string?
Yeah.
So within all of those, you can have historical or fictional campaigns. They can be narrative based, they can be competitive, or they can be a mixture of either of them. It's what you as a gamer and as a player base want to achieve.
You can start with a real world situation and then expand from that in a fictitious way. You know, what if Napoleon's invasion of Russia had been successful? Wow, where do you go from there? You know, it starts off real world and then let your imagination or the dice run wild.
Yeah, and again, it's you choose as a player base or as a player what scope of game, like what is the scope of your campaign going to be? Are you going to play the entire Napoleonic Wars? So, you know, you're covering 1803 to 1815 everywhere. Do you do the whole of World War II? Or do you go, right, actually, we're going to just do the Peninsular War, you know, with its, you know, it's only 6 years long. Or do we do the 100 Days campaign?
Yeah.
Or what about, or maybe, you know, rather than the whole of World War II, we'll do the September campaign, or we'll do Normandy. Or actually, going, you know, if you wanted to do, like we're doing, again, like currently what we're working on, the Napoleonic project, set around Waterloo, roughly, do we do the whole 100 Days campaign? Or is that even too big for what we're looking at?
Mm-hmm.
So we're just going to look at even Waterloo. And then, you know, so you have like, if you're doing the Peninsular War, or just do Salamanca. You sort of break these down and actually go, you know, we can have a full campaign based around the Battle of Waterloo quite easily. Or actually, do we pick one day at Waterloo? Do we go the picture of the main battle, one of the like preliminary battles? Do we do, you know, Blucher's battle the day before?
I mean, as we always say on the show, like, you talk to your opponents, don't you? You sit down, you have that discussion, like, what are we looking for from this campaign? Are we looking for something that's going to be the next 10 years of our life, dedicating our, you know, if your opponent has very different expectations of what they want from the campaign from you, you're not, neither of you are going to be satisfied.
No.
You know.
And, yeah, and I would say to get the most out of a campaign, it's very, very important to be like fully enmeshed in like the social contract of the gamers within that campaign.
Mm-hmm.
Because if you're going and I just want to crush my opponents and see them driven before me, and somebody else is there, they want to have a fully historical, like handicapped by the history army. And, you know, it's probably not going to be fun for either of you, because you're just going to crush them and they're just going to set their models up and then just take them off the table.
Yeah.
I think it's, that's where I would say it, having that like social contract of what do we want out of this and what do we actually all want to do before we get into it is really important. And actually having a discussion around the campaign before you set it up,
I think it's really important as well to have, at least in my experience of campaigns, is to have one person who is whether nominally just chosen as the person that is like, other people can do work, but you choose one person that is organizing it as the focal point for the decisions about what's happening with the campaign. I know we all are playing English Civil War games, but nominally it's Ed that is sort of writing the history and doing a lot of the paperwork for the battle in Hampshire.
Yeah, I would go so far as to say, I think the better the planning that goes into a campaign and sort of like the better the planning during it, the better it tends to run.
Yeah.
I think generally a rather ad hoc on the fly campaign generally either fizzles out or just doesn't really run as smoothly, or it can leave games feeling inconsequential because nobody really shows what's going on. And
I mean, it kind of got onto the point that I was, you know, I was thinking myself, is that the whole reason we play campaigns is it makes those games feel more significant. And that's the reason we have a campaign. So you want to feel, so if you can, the more planning you put in, the more significant those games will feel and the better the campaign will be.
Yeah. And I think like where campaigns really shine is that you can use, you know, maps, like other visual resources, you know, like Realm of Battle tiles, Mortal Empire, what was the GW little tiles, things that you built your area from?
Mighty Empires.
And I know there's one available on Kickstarter at the moment for some STL files, which is basically the same. You know, you have captured this tile of wasteland, like add it to your ground. Ooh. And even like games like Oathmark, where like how you build your realms, you can, a campaign could be right, we're fighting over this hill land.
Yeah.
Whoever wins this battle adds the hill land to their realm.
Mm.
You can then recruit units that are recruited from a hill land.
Yeah.
You want that giant. It's those, that kind of thing which allows that extra level of depth to your games and your ongoing games that campaigns can give you. And like in the English Civil War Battle for Hatred campaign, Ed drew the map.
Mm-hmm.
Ed, you know, he drew the map, he has the map, he controls the map. And so we tell him what's done, he's able to update the map. But then any of us run a game, we can just, you know, pop a message over to Ed. Where should we be fighting when we're fighting at the minute? And I'd be like, oh, well, you're on Pig Island or you're in front, you're at Bethelport or wherever.
Yeah.
He tells us. And then like all of a sudden, right, we're now fighting for the bridge at Bethelport. Makes the battle more it's more an enjoyable story than, oh, just have a fight over random bridge.
It makes it mean something, even if it doesn't really mean anything. But it does give, you know, the significance of, like, you can have a character that's there and then something can happen and then it adds to the storyline. It might change nothing, but it just makes it feel more significant to the people playing the game and the others when they hear that story.
And, like, it might sound like this is a huge amount of work and it isn't necessary. There are enough resources out there so this isn't a huge amount of work on your own. Like, I think the Battle for Hatred English Civil War campaign we're playing is probably towards the more like quite a lot of work level because it's a completely homebrew campaign. You know, Ed literally drew and came up with the map, named all the places. You know, it's inspired by the early years of the English Civil War, obviously. But you know, if you were wanting to, there are enough like games, both sort of historical and, you know, sci-fi fantasy, which have campaign books and all the information that you need to run the campaigns themselves, that all that background and world is already there.
Yeah.
You just run it as you want. You need.
Well, that's the thing. If you're recreating a historical campaign, a real one, that's all there to be as a resource to look at, to inspire you and to follow. You just have to make the choice of, okay, if this side wins this game, do we still follow the same historical line that it went down?
Yeah.
With fantasy, you always, you know, you are just making it up because it's, you know,
that is new. True. But there are like plenty of like sci-fi fantasy campaign books where, you know, if you want to play the Horus Heresy,
yeah,
the Siege of Terra, you know, Death of the Old World, all those sorts of things, you just pick the book up, it tells you what you want to do.
Mm-hmm.
Like, you know, if you, it might be like slightly more difficult if you were saying, right, we want to run a campaign of like the War of the Dwarves and Orcs or like the Battle of Dale during the War of the Ring, that sort of thing, where there isn't necessarily like a game A, game B, game C, game D. You have to sort of work it out a little bit more what you want to do for some of them. But, you know, again, it's how much time do you want to put in, what do you want out of it? And there are enough books out there that will like do a lot of the leading you through the steps, A, B, C, and it actually allows you to play really asymmetrical battles that allow some like reproduction of the historical events.
Because not every battle in history has been, well, I have 2,000 points of Celts and you have 2,000 points of Romans and we're going to face off exactly matched against each other. You know, most historical conflicts, one side is got a few more things than the other side.
It's almost like one of the worst things you can do in is to have a pitched battle where everything is equal.
Yes.
Sounds like this would be a really bad idea.
Yeah.
And, you know, I suppose for a great many people, like when we're chatting about just starting any army project or ever, you know, one of our first points of call is always have a look for the Osprey book.
Oh, yeah. I mean, there's 375 in their campaign series of books. So that's a great place to start if you're looking to think about doing a campaign, you know, whether it be Operation Mercury or Waterloo. They have a campaign book that you can go and just dive straight into and have a look at.
Yep, and they are fantastic. And, you know, I would recommend, no matter how familiar or unfamiliar you are with the topic, those Osprey campaign books are a great place to start. And the bibliographies in the back, it's always like, right, I'm really interested in, say you read like the Operation Crusader one, and you go, oh, this is really interesting, I'd like to know more about this, right. You look at the bibliography in the back, it will give you them books which will then bore you to tears in all the minute detail that you want that isn't easily digestible in the campaign book.
I mean, I like reading the campaign books just to read the campaign books just for fun. And my wife laughs at me. She's like, why are you reading a textbook for fun? I'm like, because it is fun to read.
Well, they are. Like, I would probably say I've read two or three of them with the intention of actually running a campaign. Mm-hmm. Based on them. The rest of them I've just read because they're interesting.
Yeah, it's just good fun.
Or I just like want information on like an army I'm doing or something, rather than I'm running this as an actual campaign.
Breaking news: two men who work in the field of history interested in reading history books. More from our reporters in the field.
Yeah, it's shock horror. Yeah.
So yeah, campaign books. I mean, you mentioned the bolt action ones, and they're fantastic. They're my first thought when I was thinking, okay, if I'm doing a campaign for a game, you know, the Fall of Berlin, you know, whatever it might be, there is a bolt action book to cover it. And the same is true for role-playing games as well. They have campaign books you can pick up. Some games have those campaign books available straight away.
And I think especially with the bolt action campaign books, as a veteran bolt action player, I have to say, they fundamentally change the game in some regards. Like they have units which fundamentally change the way, and you have especially the missions are so completely different to any other, to like the main rulebook missions, that you have to play them differently. Like you cannot play a main rulebook mission if like your opponent is given like 388s for free, as they're like, oh, just have these 388s. Doesn't work.
Yeah.
But the way the missions and like the victory conditions and the campaign books are, they work perfectly. And it just makes you be able to use the armies that you've got in a different way. Mm-hmm. But they also work really well as a modeling and hobby project, because you go, right, yeah, well, this mission I need 388s, better paint up and build some 88s.
Yeah,
which is very similar also to the, like, it seems a lot of people play Chain of Command.
Yeah,
and they just seem similar, right, I'm going to paint up all the support options for this, so we've got them for the campaign.
Yeah,
now if my Panzer 3 gets blown up in a game, I don't have my Panzer 3 knocking about anymore as a support option, so we'll probably need to take that machine gun thing instead.
Yeah.
I think that really, like, again, sort of links back to that sort of the organisation of a campaign.
Yeah.
And working out what you're doing. Like, the way the bolt action campaigns generally work is, and the ones I've played in, and I know friends who have played, they play with two of you. You know, you have, right, we're doing the Sino-Japanese War. Right, who's China, who's Japan?
Yeah, because it makes a big difference, I think, the number of players you have in the campaign. Now, you could be a whole club. We're doing English Civil War as a club. Let's get ready for that. And you can also do it as just two people. The minimum you need for a campaign, I guess one, is probably if you're playing solo. But really, it's two for a campaign.
Yeah, I think there are pros and cons for both. Like for me, as he's like a smaller player base, makes it a lot easier to make sure everyone's played their game for that round.
Mm-hmm.
If it's two of you and you go, right, we've played our game, we're moving on to the next round. If there's four of you, you go, right, has that second game been played so we can move on to round two? a larger player base adds for like possibly like a much more dynamic and larger experience. Like if we're using the bolt action, like sign a Japanese war again, if there's just two players and you've got a Japanese player and a Chinese player, you know, all the Japanese forces are going to have to be like, you know, under one banner, really. All the Chinese are going to be under another. If you had four players, you go, right, we've got Chinese nationalists and the communists. We've got the Japanese, we've got like the Imperial Army and the SNLF. You can add.
Yeah, it's nice if you can get the, for a campaign, like you really want to get the major powers covered, don't you? And then it's nice if you can introduce, you know, if you're doing English Civil War, you could just do Covenanters versus Royalists and do the Bishop War at the beginning. But it'd be nice to get parliamentarians and, you know, Royalists fighting each other, because that's kind of what you think of, isn't it?
Yeah, and you have, like, and I think in our English Civil War campaign that we've run, we've got around 10 players, and yet we have 10 different armies that are all from different parts of the country. Like, I'm playing the Northern Horse. We have, like, Cornish, we have Montrose, you've got Covenanters, you have your trained London trained bands.
Devereux, Earl of Essex. I really liked how one of the opponents, just by coincidence, had a banner that mocked Robert Devereux. And some of you will know that banner. I'm not mentioning it here.
It is quite a good banner, if it recorded in history. But again, that sort of comes down a little bit to the planning of going, right, player, who's playing this? Oh, I will play their adversary so that we have, like, we can have some true, like, matchups to sort of play these out if we want to.
Yeah, it's good if you can get a kind of agreement before you start, because you're going to try and do Napoleonics and nobody wants to play French. You might have a few issues on your hand.
Yeah.
I mean, you can still play games. You can work something out. You know, you can have the Portuguese versus the British. Maybe the Portuguese are the rising power in this alternate timeline. But, you know, you might just need to have someone play as the French.
I think that's where it comes into that a bit more, like, in-depth on that social contract bit, doesn't it? They go, right, we're playing Waterloo. We've got multiple British players. We've got multiple French players. Does anybody fancy playing the Dutch or, you know, the Prussians?
Yes.
What's going on? You know, does any, or, you know, everybody want, if we were you doing a Stalingrad campaign, you know, right, we've got loads and loads of Germans. We've got loads and loads of Soviets. Anybody fancy being the Italians or Romanians?
Yeah.
You know, so actually going, and somebody going, actually, I'm going to do this because it's going to add more flavor to the overall thing. And allows, it's just what really can bring a bigger campaign to life. And just,
yeah, you might be surprised. Someone might have those armies and they'll be so happy to actually get to use them in the right environment. Oh, I've had Romanians at Stalingrad hidden in my cupboard for 5 years. I painted them up as a project, never got to use them. Brilliant. This is a perfect opportunity. Love to bring them along.
Yeah, because I think of every game so far that my Eastern Front Italians have played has either been like American paratroopers in Normandy or Japanese Pacific Island defenders. They seem to sort of get teleported several thousand miles east or west. Yes. Never actually fight where they're supposed to be.
Wow. I mean, yeah.
You can fight on this sort of parallel. You can fight on like a horizontal line, which can zip you east or west, wherever you are. But again, that sort of like comes down to like organization and how we were talking in the last episode about the combined arms thing that's been come out for bolt action. Like if you have a bunch of disparate players, you go, right, we're playing a campaign that's based in Northern Europe, but the two Victory at Seas players have got specific fleets. Well, we're going to play the Battle of Midway, but we're going to somehow work out that it's going to affect the Channel Crossing.
Yeah, like supply routes or something, you know, or goods coming in.
You can very easily do that. And, you know, this, like, the organisation, I think it's a good way when you're chatting stuff about how is this campaign going to work, actually what level of organization is going to be. Is it going to be, you know, free and fairly easy? You just like record wins, losses, and like in-game events don't carry over from one game to the next. You know, so you don't need to do like detailed bookkeeping both during the game or after the game. You just say, you know, parliamentarians won, the royalists won, you know, it was a draw, move on to the next game.
Yeah.
Whereas if you're going, right, the parliamentarians lost 23 pikemen, 15 shot and a cannon, and the royalists inflicted 15 casualties and one unit of dragoons failed the morale test. And so I think that is another level of bookkeeping. And
you can make it as complicated as you want to make it.
Yeah. And I think, you know, probably people who have played like Blood Bowl, Necromunda, those sorts of things, where you keep a record of each individual model's like actions during the game, because they get incrementally better game to game.
Star player points.
Got
to get them skills.
And also, you know, like injuries, wounds, that sort of thing is both more timekeeping on the gamer's point, but also a lot more work on the person who's running it, because you need to have a database and put all that in. And I know, anecdotally, I was talking to somebody who had been running a Blood Bowl campaign a few years ago, and they said that it took them at least one day a week, really, to like up to keep up the like the database of all the star player points and the casualties, and so that, and it that was because like that league had about 40, I think it was either 40 to 60 players, but it was like who scored the most touchdowns, who's had the most interceptions, who had the most fumbles. That's just an awful amount of work. And you know, the person like the league commissioner or whoever who's running that, they have to know going into it, right, I am
definitely
able to deal with all this work. And actually, you know, just right, I can organize 30 people playing 15 games a month, and I can chase them all up and go, have you played your game before I put out the next load of league fixtures?
Yeah.
Some people probably find that a huge amount of fun. Other people, it will probably be an absolute nightmare too. Yeah. And
I think it's important to be honest with yourself at the beginning, exactly how much work you want to do. And it might surprise you when you start, you know, how much you've done. And it's fine to talk to the players and say, look, we need to adjust this because it's just not working. Or split the work. Or maybe you'll find it's not an issue at all and actually you can do a bit more.
I think it's always better to start off smaller and expand your scope rather than sort of trying to be overly ambitious before you begin, because I cannot overemphasize how difficult it can be to get a group of people together regularly.
Oh my God.
To play a game.
Oh my God. You would think, like, how difficult can it be to get 4 or 5 adults to agree on one day a month to meet together to do role playing? It's like, what is wrong with everyone? I honestly have been a D&D campaign and been like, I am never busy. How is it that of the 31 days of that month that the one day that I am busy, everyone else is free?
You know, I've been playing in a Doomamount campaign for about 4 years now, I think. And we have 6 players in the DM. And there's a handful of occasions when we've all been there together. Nearly always, there's at least 1 or 2 people who just can't make it.
Yeah.
And it's just, that's 7 of us. And if you also, you know, I think probably chatting about Blood Bowl quite a lot today, because it's probably like a campaign game that lots of people play, and you can have big leagues with it. If you've got 20 games of Blood, if you've got a 40 player league and you need 20 games playing in a month, getting, you know, 40 people to be able to get one game in a month, it can be an absolute nightmare. And it's why I no longer play in the Blood Bowl leagues, because I ended up traveling all over London to get my random game of Blood Bowl, and because I wasn't free the one Wednesday night my opponent was or something. And I like playing Blood Bowl, But it just, for me, was sometimes I'm really busy this week. I don't really want to go on like a 2-hour commute to the other side of town to play a game for 90 minutes. But I need to, because I need to get my game in for the league.
I mean, I'm starting to question your dedication to Sparkle Motion, Tom. I think it leads on to a larger point of dedication upon the people who are playing in a campaign or league, whatever it might be. You know, to some people, they've got stuff going on in their life. And, you know, this is a game. It's supposed to be fun. It's supposed to be relaxing. And if you have stuff going on that literally means you cannot play that game, you have to kind of, as an organizer, accept it. But I've been in lots of campaigns, big organized games, like we did the Badab campaign. First game of the campaign, 60 people are going to be playing in it. By the end of it, there's like less than 10 people because people's interest kind of fizzled out a little bit. So I think you have to be aware that you may not finish with the same number of people as you start. And everyone's commitment levels could be different to that campaign.
I would imagine the vast majority of war game campaigns actually do fizzle out. And when I was sort of thinking about this, I came up with a little list. And mm-hmm. I don't know if you would agree with this. I think the reason why they fizzle out is quite often there's just too long between games.
Yep.
And so you go, actually, you know, Bad Dab War. Oh, when did we play the last Bad Dab War game? March. It's now July. I've played lots of games in between since then.
Because you're so busy trying to schedule that it never happens, and then it just never happens again.
Yeah. Or it's too great a commitment on the players. It feels like you've got no time for playing something else or doing something else. I've got this campaign. It almost becomes oppressive.
Yeah.
That's my experience from the last Blood Bowl campaign I played. It just felt like I had no time.
You start to resent having to play it. It's like, I'm resenting this thing that's supposed to be fun. Again, it's a game. It's supposed to be fun. You shouldn't be like dreading, oh no, the campaign game. I've got to play it. I've got all these other things I want to do. Well, just be honest.
Yeah. Also, too much commitment on the organizer. Everyone's wanting to play the game, but they don't know who they're playing because it's all just held up because the paperwork hasn't been done by the organizer telling people who to play. I think also players lose interest in the game.
Yeah.
You know, I think especially if you're a bit of a hobby butterfly and you flip from game to game, actually go, after 18 months, I don't want to play this.
Oh, I'm totally going to play this. I've just spent £200 on models for English Civil War. I'm totally going to paint those up. I'm going to enjoy playing this. You paint 20 and then suddenly you're playing Stargrove.
Yeah.
You know.
And I think then my last two sort of points, I think, are sort of, again, I've personally experienced this. You know, games can become like wildly unbalanced and then like really basically unfun as campaigns progress. Oh. You know, you're playing like a Necromunda campaign and I haven't played modern Necromunda, but like old Necromunda, but like your opponent gang, everyone's got like grenade launchers with multiple kinds of grenades. It's like, well, there's nothing I'm doing this turn. Or also like the potential there to be for like a runaway winner, which sort of makes like you're playing a Blood Bowl league, for example, and you're playing 20 games, but by like game 15, someone is so many points in front, they can lose their last 5 games and still win.
Yeah,
it's like there's nothing to play for. Like we are just playing a series of dead rubbers, and again, I think that can be well. We're done. We'll sort it out.
It can go the other way as well for the organizer. I've run that was Warhammer Fantasy roleplay campaign, and one of the characters became like a combat machine. So I'd have to set up every encounter. Well, there's one really tough guy, and a load of mooks for everyone else to fight, and I'd have to like pair up the two. It's like trying to engineer it. I'm like, oh, this week everyone's weapons have gone missing because I just, they're trying to like unpower the overpowered people. And then it's like, well, how much fun is it for the person that's really happy that they've got the guy to be super powered? And every week you're having to find a new way to like nerf them for that round of combat. You know, it's just not fair on them either.
Well, I think that's that social contract thing, isn't it? Because I had the exact same thing with a homebrew 40k roleplay Dark Heresy campaign I ran for like several years.
Yeah.
And somebody played a Munchkin Tech Priest in that. And they were so tough that for me to get through their armor and do like 1 point of damage to them would instantly kill any other member in the party.
Yeah.
And I was always like, well, you're facing like 11 cultists with rusty spoons, and one of them has got a las cannon.
Yeah.
The las cannon is always shooting at the tech priest, and it was unfun for everybody else. But like this character, for example, like they had been built in such an unfun way. They had like a super powered armored leg with loads of extra armor and stuff, and they'd been able to like get gear and traits and perks and all sorts. That basically meant that they could choose where damage went. So yeah, they would always have damage on this leg. And it was just ridiculous. And it was unfun for me. And actually, after that campaign had been running for years, and then like shortly after they learned the ability, just all damage goes to their leg, the whole thing just fell apart.
Well, that bit about social contract is not just social contract for the person running it, but the person playing as well, to go, do you know what? I did this experiment. It was successful. I've shown I can do this. I've made this character nearly unkillable. It's done. Time to retire that character and start a new one.
Some really well-planned campaigns have a mechanism in that. Like I've seen Necromunda campaigns run, for example, which like when your gang rating gets to a certain level, you know, they've become powerful enough to move up out of the Enderhive, and they move on out of the slums. They move up the hive somewhere better. You know, they're seen as too good. The same as Blood Bowl teams, they can be right. You're too good. Your team, you know, is now too good for this league. They're now in like an all-star league.
They've been promoted to Division One.
Yeah. You know, they're now in the Champions League.
They're playing in Europe.
The league anymore.
Yeah.
And I think I think that comes with experience of going, actually, right, if you're playing Blood Bowl and somebody's got a 2 million rated team and you're rocking up with your starting roster a million, it's not going to be much fun for either of you, really. Whereas you go, right, actually, once you get to 1500 million, you're off. You tire your team. You just think, or go, right.
I think there's a mechanism in Frostgrave, isn't there? Because there's a master spell that lets your wizard basically ascend to the next plane of. So it's good when they have built-in systems that allow you to, you know,
bring like a natural limit to the power of your character, just rather than growing exponentially. If you've played any of like the Bethesda games, you know, at some point you get to a certain level where you can just like walk around and punch everybody to death in your pants.
Yeah.
And just like, I can now take off my god tier armor because I have, you know, I've been to the cantons of Vivek and punched Vivek to death in my pants and nicked his magic ring, and now nobody can touch me. It just, that's fun for 10 minutes.
It's like when you're playing a computer game and you're on the last level and you've got every single upgrade, and you're like, you've basically completed the game, and you go back and you're like, this game is no fun anymore because even my worst weapon can kill everything in the game.
Yeah.
It's like, what's the fun in playing a game where you can just walk around and just kill everything? Although I feel we're getting slightly off topic here.
Yeah. Well, I think most of that really sort of links into actually like different types of game link themselves to different kind of campaigns.
Yeah.
I think you have like, what's sort of like, I think you called them like the Plain Jane war game. Things like Kings of War, bolt action. You know, a campaign can be no more in depth than a series of pickup games.
Yeah.
Or it can be really complicated where, you know, carry over losses, you have skill progression for units and that sort of thing, but it's as detailed as you want it to be. You build the game you want with it,
because you can have a league if all you want to do is have I play you, I beat you, I won or lost the game, or it was a draw. You can do that. It doesn't have to be a campaign. You can just have a league with no progression between games. Literally, I fight you, we get result, we move on to the next thing, and there's no link at all. It's just literally like going to a tournament and having a tournament of, you know, 40K or whatever it is you might be playing.
Well, yeah, Warlord themselves have run some bolt action campaign days, which are tournaments.
Yeah.
You know, it's like I did the D-Day one, it was like, right, are you an Allied or an Axis player? Just bring 1,000 points that's themed however you want it to be to have been around on D-Day. And it was, right, I just played 3 games against Allied players that day. It was technically a campaign game, but it was also a tournament. It's just how that works. I think there are also like a slightly different style of game today is like the campaign war game, which is based primarily about skill progression and how you force getting better game to game. So, you know, things like Frostgrave, Stargrave, you know, some 40k Necromunda. That's the thing, like, you know, like it's much more fun to play, I think, like with a Frostgrave Warband when your wizard's got some skills and can cast spells off a little bit better.
Yeah.
Than how they were differently. And I think like that's a like campaign war game based around skill progression. I think it's very similar but slightly different to the sports games where you play just like a number of games in a league, you know, and things like, you know, Blood Bowl, Dread Bowl, Rumble Slam, you know, your team gets better, you're getting skills, but you can't control it quite so much, you know, like star player points, that sort of stuff. So you can't necessarily, you go in with your starting roster, but actually like how your skills work out at the end of it. Like, you know, once you've played 10 games with a Blood Bowl team, and like actually the stats and how your team looks is probably going to be nothing like what you initially envisioned. Oh, it's fantastic. I've got like a throwing skill on that like stunty guy who's like got a broken leg. Or, you know, that's
a plus one strength goblin. That's what we're talking about. That's real. That's Blood Bowl right there. A blocking goblin. That's what we all want.
Yes. Yeah. But then saying that, you were in a game where like that goblin gets like 9 star player point. He gets star player like 9 times. I actually go, see your star player there. You're this goblin's going to take him out like a kidney shot. be a pity if something happened to that troll. Actually, goblin just, you know, snips up and takes him out. But you're saying that you then have this like god tier goblin, and then in like your final game, the crowd throws a rock at him and just kills him.
Yeah, he's just pushed in the crowd, gone.
Just gone before you're gone. And then you have the, you know, the final campaign style thing is, you know, the D&D RPG campaigns. And I think they as we've talked with previous talking about, like how you have that like power level and you go, when you get to this level, you move on, all that sort of thing. I think those have the jumping in points almost of like, I joined the D&D campaign I play in, I joined at level 4 after they'd already been playing a few years. And like, we're now at like level 12. And so we are now doing stuff that is like, when we were level 4, is now considered like god tier stuff. And yet if somebody had to drop out and join in, they can start a level 12 character and like jump in. And I think that is, if a longer running campaign has options for people to like want to come in and drop out, I think it can sort of keep it revitalized and working. Because as you said, you know, you might start off with like a bad app campaign with 60 people and end with 12. But if you halfway through and say, oh, I'd really like to play some bad app, I've got this army ready, giving them a place where they can like fit in the narrative works.
Absolutely. We've definitely role playing. I've jumped into the middle of campaigns and joined in, and it's fine. Like, it's weird the first week, and then it's like you've always been there after like about 4.
Or like, you know, your character dies. Right, you're not just going to leave the campaign. You go, right, well,
yeah.
Am I now just going to follow you around as like a disembodied spirit?
I did have a DM who was like, no, that's it. You're out of the campaign. When I start my next campaign, I'll call you up. Literally, if you died, you were out of the game. You didn't come for a few weeks till that game was... Because it wouldn't be a long campaign, like over years. It'd be like, I'm doing this module for like 5 sessions. And then at the end, I'll start a new one. And he wouldn't let you come back until the end of that module. Because he thought it was unrealistic. Oh, no, that person's died. And just by coincidence, on the same day as he died, this other person just turned up.
Oh, like, dear. Frowning Bob has died, but you've found Smiley Joe.
Exactly. I can see that argument. It's like, it did give you that kind of, it generally made you fear your character's dying more if you knew there'd be a consequence, which I guess is something.
I can see the I can see the appeal of permadeath. I can also see the thing of like, I'm not joining that campaign again. And I'm thinking, okay, I will take my dice and roll them somewhere else, so I can see how it ends or how the story is told. It's almost like, nope, you failed. That's it. You don't get to see the end. I think that would probably stick in my craw.
Yeah,
a bit, and I would flounce out in a huff.
Well, if you have an opinion on this story, please join us on the Facebook group. It's the best way to stay in contact and hear what's happening with the Hobby Support Group online on the Facebook group. If you do want to join, please answer the questions. I'm afraid you can't join the group. We will decline your application. So please answer the questions and join us on Facebook.
But I think in sort of conclusion, Andy, really, what we've been talking about with campaigns is they are what you want them to be, aren't they? There's plenty of structure out there for you want to take, but how with everything, you can form it and mold it to how it fits the needs of you, your player base, your club, whatever.
It should be adding more fun as well. I think, you know, you should be looking forward to these sessions and enjoying yourself and bringing the group together.
Yeah, I think that's maybe like a great point to end on, is that a campaign should enhance your fun. It should make the gaming more fun. Yeah. Not just extra work. It's like, how do we add this, the extra spice and the extra garnish to our gaming? And that's what campaigns can do.
Yeah, sounds good to me.
Well, thank you very much, to speak to you soon.
Thanks, Tom. Take care, everyone.